I'll do so. Thank you. It's a great pleasure being here and to be part of this inspiring atmosphere here at Santa Barbara. I will be talking about ultrafast laser-induced spin transfer torque. That's quite a mouthful. That's also because I will be combining different topics, some of which you are quite familiar with, and some maybe a bit less. Probably many of you are aware of what is happening nowadays in the field of ultrafast magnetization dynamics, exciting magnetic structures with femtosecond laser pulses, but I think there's very little theoretical activities here in this community of the people who are here. You're much more familiar with the other topic which I will be combining, that of spin transfer torque. And to picturize that, I have here an image of the famous racetrack memory. And even part of what I will be talking about has a close link to spin calorimetrics. So everything is dumped into one experiment, which I try to explain during the forthcoming hour. Before starting off, important acknowledgements, and actually I would say it's strange that I am the experimentalist of the week, I would say, apart from the fact that I'm just a semi-experimentalist of the week, because there are two this week, but I think that the honor is really for those guys who really did all the experiments I will be showing. Sjors Gellekens did brilliant work. He will be defending his PhD thesis in March, and Koen Kuiper already in November. Having said that, this is kind of the outline of my talk, also capturing the basic physics which I will be addressing. We have some kind of magnetic structure, for instance, a thin ferromagnetic film on top of a non-magnetic metal, and we're exciting it with a femtosecond laser pulse, and we want to know what's going on and what can we learn from that. Now, in principle, you can distinguish two types of processes. The one thing is it's purely local. I will heat up, for instance, my magnetic film. I will introduce spin disorder, and thereby I will see this as a shrinkage of the magnetization vector. And that is then a purely local process. But there can be other processes going on, and that idea has attracted a lot of interest over the past few years. That is, all the dynamics is not necessarily local. I create hot electrons, and they move around in random directions, but at speeds of the Fermi velocity, so they can travel quite a distance. And so I basically will also get spin currents in my structure. And those might also be relevant for understanding the local magnetization dynamics, but you might even think of exploiting them. So this is a bit more detail what I will be talking about. I do start with a couple of slides on local magnetization dynamics, just to give you a bit of more background. And also introduce some of the recent experiments which have triggered the issue of spin transfer on the femtosecond timescale. And some of you will be familiar with the concept of a super diffusive transport, which has been introduced. Then the main part of the presentation is on the laser-induced spin transfer torque. I will explain a bit why the configuration we implemented is thought to be very efficient. Our experiments, some of the experimental details, and also what information we can extract from it, and what the interpretation should be of what we are seeing, and what the link here is to the community here who are collected here today. And finally, I will step back and see whether the spin transfer spin currents we are seeing, how much they then are expected to affect the local magnetization dynamics with which I will start. Okay, so simple question, what happens after femtosecond laser excitation? And actually this turns out to be an extremely rich field. And over the past 17 years, the first reports were in 1996 by the Strasbourg group, Eric Beaurepaire, Jean-Yves Bigot group, where they show that, actually that was just the example I gave before. I mean, the basic thing which happens if I absorb a femtosecond laser pulse, I heat up the material, I introduce additional spin disorder, spin temperature goes up and the magnetization goes down. So that's a very basic and simple process. But it turns out that there's much more happening and very fascinating processes. First of all, what you can do by heating up the material, you're also going to modify the anisotropy. And if you're in the proper configuration, thereby you can trigger magnetization precession and also trigger spin waves. So that's one option. We and a couple of other groups have also shown that it's possible that if you have very specific materials, For instance, materials which have a phase transition from antiferromagnetic at lower temperatures or room temperature to ferromagnetic above. Iron, rhodium is such a well-known component. If you heat them up, actually you go from a state without a magnetic moment to a state with a magnetic moment. So rather than quenching the magnetic moment, in this case, with a femtosecond laser pulse, you can induce a magnetic moment. Now, there's also been very famous experiments showing that actually it's not only quenching of growth, but you can even switch the magnetization of a thin film and actually do it helicity dependent. So you have a single femtosecond laser pulse, and depending on whether you have it left or right circularly polarized, you can switch your magnet to the up or to the down state. And most recently, it has been shown that actually you can also exploit the internal exchange interactions in ferromagnets. So if you have two spin sublattices which have the opposite orientation, you can exploit this exchange interaction to switch such a ferromagnetic material just with a single laser pulse, even if it's linearly polarized. So a lot of different things you can achieve by just using a single laser pulse. Yes?
Also switching by circle polarized light, that's also ferromagnetic always or not always?
No, well, this is a strange case, because the original explanation was in terms of inverse Faraday effect, as you might know. Yeah. And more recently, it turned out to actually be just dichroism. And probably what is switching here is the same phenomenon as what's switching here. At the end, it is the same.
So
yes. Although by symmetry, in principle, it should be possible by the inverse Faraday effect, but for the
experiments are always ferromagnets.
Yes. These experiments have all been done on rare earth transition metal compounds. Okay, so this is probably a diagram which all of you must have seen a dozen of times. It was the first experiment showing that if you have a femtosecond laser pulse, shine it on a thin ferromagnetic nickel film, what you see is the magneto optical contrast drops down significantly within the first picosecond. So that is the basic experiment. You can plot it in a slightly different way, look into the material. The most simple phenomenological interpretation of that is as follows. And it's good because it introduces a couple of important time scales. This material, of course, has different degrees of freedom. You can distinguish a charge degree of freedom, electrons, lattice degree of freedom, the phonons, and the spin degree of freedom, say the magnons. And you can associate a temperature to each of them. And what happens upon absorption of a femtosecond laser pulse, the energy is absorbed by electronic excitations. So first you create very highly excited electrons, but those scatter due to electron-electron scattering very efficiently, and thereby the electron system thermalizes. And the thermalization time is typically 50 to 100 femtoseconds. That's the first time scale. Then you have a hot electron system and a cold lattice, and now via electron-phonon coupling, those two systems equilibrize. And that's the second time scale. And for the transition metals, which we are discussing here, that is a pretty efficient process as well. And typically, that takes about half a picosecond. But then, of course, there's also energy transfer from the electron and the phonon system towards the spin system. And you will see this as a drop of the magnetization and a recovery at a time that the electron temperature is cooling down due to interaction with lattice. And this is the third time scale, and of course the most important time scale if we are interested in magnetization dynamics. And surprisingly, and this is actually the time scale which was measured for the first time in the experiment by Beaurepaire, this time scale is about 0.1 to 0.2 picosecond, and is faster than the electron-phonon equilibration time in these materials. And that was a very big surprise.
Yes. And the original experiment that was kind of local. In a sense, there was no like metallic substrate or anything like that,
where
spins could go?
I think it was a pretty thick film.
Uh-huh. So it's conceivable that maybe there's some transfer actually.
Yes. Okay. Yes. Yeah.
And this numbers that you have, they said just kind of sort of based on the experimental.
Yes. Yeah. No, I think these curves here are fits from one of our papers to the nickel experiment.
But in terms of like theory, like yes. Do these numbers match some kind of simple theoretical?
That's what I will show in a couple of slides from now. Yes.
I have also a layman question to this.
Yes.
Yeah. You have like a gray arrow between spits and lattice kind of suggesting that there are some mechanisms of direct relaxation.
Yes, yes.
Yes.
Can you respond to that? Well, actually, the diagram I have here is, I will also return to that, but the diagram I have here is basically what is usually used for the so-called three-temperature model, where you just introduce phenomenological coupling constants between the electron and lattice system, between the lattice and the spin, and between the spin and the electrons. The fact that this is a bit weaker is emphasizing that you could expect that spin lattice relaxation is a relatively slow process.
Yeah, because I mean, if I think about it naively, I would say, yes. I mean, they only relax via electrons.
Yes, yeah. I think they don't have the diagram, but after I have shown what we think the answer is, I could show a modified diagram which is more is to the point, I think. Clearly, the important issue here is conservation of angular momentum. I start with a magnetized system. After having heated it up, the angular momentum has to go somewhere. And you could think, well, of course, I have work around with laser fields, so it could be photons in or out, spherically polarized photons. It could be transfer actually purely within the electronic system. I create a highly excited state, so it might even be just be transfer between spin and orbital degree of freedom. Or surprisingly, there would be a very fast deposition of angular momentum towards lattice. Now, I'll just show you two slides. I mean, I could have bring a lot of slides. I could have been talking a couple of hours on this, but just two experiments which I think are very interesting to show a bit more about the underlying physics. This is beautiful work by the Hellman-Dürr group using femtosecond sliced XMCD. So with this femtosecond XMCD, you know, with XMCD, you can probe elements specifically, but you can also probe independently the orbital and spin degree of freedom. And that's what they did a couple of years ago, and this is the result. So now you see the same experiment, now not a magneto-optical experiment like Beaurepaire did, but what you see is now by XMCD on a femtosecond time scale, the drop of the spin momentum moment, but at the same time the drop of the orbital momentum moment. So you see both go more or less hand in hand. So there's not a very fancy process, highly excited. You could think that all the spin momentum is dumped into orbital momentum, maybe as a temporary state, but it stays there so shortly that you cannot measure it. So that's a very important message as to it limits the phase space in which you can find the answers.
But of course, the coupling from the orbital degrees of freedom of the lattice
yes.
is the fastest time scale in the problem.
Yes, yes. That is a possibility that you say I have fast spin orbit scattering, and the orbital
not necessarily fast spin orbit, but orbit lattice is fastest.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
But here, this is orbital magnetic moment. That's orbital still kind of it's still pretty microscopic in a sense, right? It's not like orbital that has to do with this kind of.
That's atomic.
No.
But that's all that matters
yeah.
in these systems.
Yes.
The atomic orbital
moments. Right. This is the orbital.
The crystal field potential is the biggest potential in the problem. Right. So the fact that orbital moments are quenched in these materials is because the crystal field is a huge potential.
So that's the time scale that you alluding to.
Yeah. Good. Then the question whether the laser field might play a role. Of course, you have huge laser fields in the femtosecond, focused into the femtosecond, and highly excited electrons, and you could think that they play an important role. And actually, that originally was the idea, and if you look at this experiment, you see that there is a reason to, because this red bar is the first 100 femtosecond where you have a strong laser field and you have highly excited electrons, and it seems that almost all the magnetization dynamics takes place then. But if you take exactly the same film and do the experiment at large laser fluence, then you see that the magnetization dynamics slows down. The minimum is only reached after a picosecond, and you see that most of the demagnetization takes place at exactly the same rate as initially, well after the laser field is over and well after you have any hot electrons left in the system. So this may indicate that those highly excited electrons and strong laser fields might not be that decisive. So that is one temporary conclusion, and based on all kind of other experiments, we came to the conclusion that most probably it is very fast dissipation of angular momentum into the lattice. There is actually no other way. And you could think it thereby as a kind of ultra-fast de Haas and Einstein experiment. I'm not sure whether everyone is familiar with that. It's basically the idea when you have a demagnetized bar, you suddenly switch on the magnetization, you will start and the bar starts to rotate, which is just a coherent phonon.
Right, but of course that's still spin to orbit to lattice.
Yes. Yes.
Not direct spin lattice.
You probably don't separate spin and orbit, right, somehow. It's so strongly coupled.
It's spin orbit coupling is not that strong. Right, I mean it's the orbit lattice coupling is strong.
So when we say spin to orbit, which orbit now do you have in mind?
The spin orbit coupling that you have in an atom.
Yeah.
Inside of an atom.
Yep.
Yeah, but that's not strong.
Well, and certainly it's strong enough to get you into the femtosecond time scales. I mean, if it's a tens of electron volt, I mean that's even 10 femtoseconds. Yeah.
Then it's certainly strong. Enough.
Yeah.
Sorry, it's a naive question.
Yes, no.
Is it mostly theorem or is mostly localized? Or what about nickel?
Nickel is an itinerant paramagnet. It's a band-like ferromagnet.
I read that even in iron, you don't describe it fully with stoner legs.
Well, it's always a bit more complicated. Yes, I forgot that makes the story very complicated. A very simple model for magnetism is not available for these materials. So basically, the intriguing thing for this is that, I mean, you can think of doing an ab initio calculation of the whole process, but that's not possible. So whatever proposal there have been, it is always a very strong simplification of the real world. Now,
it is itinerant, but it's also very strongly atomic-like. Right. If you look at where the moments are, they're all around the atoms, not spread out. It's just at the
the orbitals, yes.
From atom to atom.
Yes.
So
Okay. So, then just following up basically what I said. I mean, we thought, well, what would be the simplest possible model Hamiltonian, which includes enough ingredients that potentially it could give, it could reproduce some of the experiments. And that was the way we set up a model. And again, I mean, of course, there are extremely simplifying approximations here, but I think it is difficult to get simpler than this. For the electrons, we assume a constant density of states, so that is only one parameter, density of states. For the phonons, you need at least two parameters. You need a density of modes and an energy scale, for instance, the Debye energy. For the spins, you need at least two parameters, an exchange coupling strength, and we implemented a simple mean field Weiss model in which the Curie temperature or exchange coupling, whatever you want, they're proportional, is a parameter, and the atomic moment. Then you need coupling between the degrees of freedom. There's electron-electron coupling, electron-electron scattering. We assumed it to be infinitely efficient, so that the scattering time is zero, and thereby the electron system is always in thermal equilibrium. That just makes it simpler to handle.
But what you have in mind is just kind of for the particle scattering, just T square over from energy kind of thing?
Yes, it was. What?
I'm just wondering, like, you know, if it's feasible to make that assumption that it happens. The
point is you have energy level and you have some kind of thermal population of them, and by this assumption you take care that the electron system is always nicely in a Fermi
what
direct distribution.
Really zero, like what is the time scale that it has to be fast enough on?
Well,
how does it compare to like T scale from energy?
Typically, I mean, what you do, of course, you create an electron at an energy of 1 to 2 electron volt. The lifetime of this primarily electron.
That's like basically that gives you the energy scale essentially.
Yes, and this one electron, one electron volt electron has a lifetime of a few femtoseconds only. And then you have a whole cascade process. So basically, this electron scatters another electron out of the Fermi sea. Then I have
about one femtosecond that you expect.
Yes, but then this whole, as I explained, this whole thermalization process, this whole cascade, is kind of finalized within 50 to 100 femtoseconds. Then you indeed, if you look again at the system, it's not anymore that you can distinguish a few highly excited electrons. Then again, you have a nicely Fermi-Dirac profile with an elevated temperature. And we assume that basically this establishing of this Fermi-Dirac profile after laser excitation is going very rapidly.
Like on the scale of tens of femtoseconds.
Yes, faster than we can measure.
And what you can measure.
Yeah, so basically you say this approximation doesn't matter as long as you look in the system after 100 femtoseconds.
And you're going to do that only because you can in principle look.
Well, you can look faster if you want. Yeah.
Okay, so interested in beyond tens of femtoseconds.
Yes. But again, just to get the first flavor of what's happening.
So this is only true because they are so hot together, right?
Yes, but if there were not these hot electrons, then it wouldn't matter too much either. There's electron-phonon scattering, which of course is important because it equilibrizes the electron system in the phonon system. And this gives an additional matrix element, but we just fit it such that we get the proper electron-phonon equilibration time of about 0.4, 0.5 picoseconds. So thereby we know this matrix element. And then the conjecture is that the spin dynamics we can describe by Elliott-Yavette type of spin flip scattering, where if I have a momentum scattering of electron with a phonon, for instance, then there is a possibility that the electron flips its spin. And this is, you could say, the only adjustable parameter in the theory. And at the moment, let's say, it's just an assumption.
But by this definition, then it's slower than electron phonon.
It is slower than electron phonon. Yes, but the interesting thing is that you find out that although, of course, this is by at least a factor of 10 slower than the bare electron phonon scattering, you find that the time at which the magnetic system equilibrizes is faster than electron phonon. And the reason for that is the following. There's only very little energy in the phonon. So to cool down a hot electron, I need many, many electron phonon scattering events. Whereas to get rid of the magnetization, most of the materials we're considering have an atomic magnetic moment of about one Bohr magneton. So one spin flip scattering is enough to quench the full magnetic moment per atom.
So then this electron phonon, that's really the full energy relaxation that you assume. So then you're saying that
it's
actually much faster than that?
This process is much more rare than this one.
Yeah, it's much more rare.
Yes. But if you then plug in these matrix elements, and so what we next did, so basically this defines your Hamiltonian. Then you apply Fermi's golden rule. You set up a set of Boltzmann equations. And then you reproduce what the temporal profiles of the electron temperature, the phonon temperature, and the magnetization is. And then the surprising outcome is that even though this number is much smaller than one, you can still have a magnetization dynamics which is much faster than the electron phonon equilibration time. And again, that is because I need a lot of these scattering effects to make to cool down a hot electron, because each phonon carries only a little energy, but each electron spin flip is almost as can bring down the full Bohr magneton down in magnetization.
But still, the time scale for that is like few picoseconds for electron spin
flip. No, it will be because this time scale is tens of femtoseconds. The electron phonon scattering. This is the macroscopic, the ensemble to bring the whole electron system in equilibrium with the phonon. This is the bare.
Okay, it's just that one.
Yes.
So is it necessary that last term goes into a phonon?
No.
It could just go directly into the lab.
Yes, so we worked out both momentum scattering with phonons as well as impurities.
Or not even impurities. Again, spin orbit to crystal field would go pretty fast.
That's something we didn't consider. So actually, we were talking a long time about this, but I will be interesting to have more discussion on this during the rest of the week. Let's skip this one. Just one final message is that despite the simplicity of this model, it turns out that it can reproduce a surprisingly large number of absorbed phenomena. Without further adjusting parameters, you automatically get also magnetization dynamics. It is noted, for instance, gadolinium has a very strange behavior, a first demagnetization in about a picosecond and then a much slower on tens of picoseconds afterwards, that automatically it's an extremely simple set of differential equations you have, you plug it in and you get it. Same applies to temperature and laser fluence dependence. If you fit your parameter at room temperature, low laser fluence, you can predict what's happened if you heat up your material towards a cure temperature or go to higher laser fluence. If you add a second spin system in the same way, but with not with spin a half, but if you add a spin 3/2 system or spin 1, and you have exchange coupling, you automatically reproduce the switching here. And all of this, if you now fit, using this model, fit the profiles to the experiment, you get a spin flip probability of approximately 0.1, which actually is also what is calculated as spin flip probabilities for these materials based on band structure calculations. So that is all, you could say, surprising, given the simpleness of the model. And I should then finally note, although the microscopic origin of our model is slightly different, the final dynamics which you get is very similar to, for instance, what is done in atomistic LLT and Landolisch's Bloch. Just to emphasize that that's not completely unique what we're doing. Only starting from the simple model Hamiltonian, that's a unique step. And thereby you do get some more microscopic insight. Yet, this looks very promising. But there are a lot of questions. Some of them were also the questions you already addressed. I mean, the way this angular momentum transfer to phonons and which phonons, etc. I mean, we have no idea. The fact that basically in the first 100 femtoseconds seems that the dynamics goes approximately the same efficiency as later, but that's why is that? Why don't the highly excited electrons completely mess up the picture? Also the magnetic excitations we make. There's a lot of discussion at the moment in the field which types of magnetic excitation you actually should take into account. I thought about the rare earth. We mapped out the same model onto rare earth ferromagnets. We have some reason why we do it, but I mean, certainly there's a lot of open questions there as well. Something which Mike just referred to. So basically, in a sense, you could say this is almost like a three particle. I have an electron phonon, and at the same time I create a spin flip. It could maybe that this is just a kind of way to model two successive processes. First, where you create electronic orbital momentum, which is very rapidly deposited into the lattice. Maybe that is the ideal or the final microscopic picture. But I mean, this is all open.
But you can't really address those questions unless you have some knobs. Temperature somehow.
Yeah.
That's almost impossible somehow because everything happens so rapidly.
Well, we played around a lot with knobs. Like I said, I mean, we did extensive temperature dependence studies. We did extensive fluence-dependent studies, and then again, the surprising thing is that the predictions of the model are then very accurate. But of course, you do not the real excitations you make. That is something where there's very little experimental information. So basically, the ensemble average, how that behaves, is kind of clear, and you have knobs there. You can compare what the model would predict. But of course, one thing is that you would really like to see which phonons, some more targeted experiments. But then, of course, it could still be that although it matches well, it could still be something else. And one claim which came a couple of years ago was that indeed it is not a local process. And it might just be a kind of illusion because we have a thin film. For instance, a nickel on aluminum. And we excite it from the front. and we probe it magneto-optically from the front, and we see that the magneto-optical contrast goes down, but it could well be that all the spins hide in the deeper layers. So that at the end, the total magnetic moment of the system does not decrease, but it's just a kind of optical illusion that where you see it, the spin momentum has disappeared.
It's again a stupid question. I mean, if you give this laser pulse,
yes,
what special scales can it
go? Well, I would say the diameter is typical. Well, depends on the experiment, micrometers up to hundreds of micrometers. The important scale, the dimension is such, it actually it's a one-dimensional, it's always a one-dimensional picture because the attenuation depth of the laser is typically 10 to 20 nanometers. So even if you tightly focus, it's still a one-dimensional problem. And he, for instance, all the transfer properties in the rate in the transfer direction are too slow. So it's really a one-dimensional problem. Either it's local or it's one-dimensional. The Uppsala group has worked on this, Spironitis field, and actually they have come up with the idea of super diffusive transport. And this now again has to do with the lifetime of these highly excited electrons, and the fact that the spin up and the spin down, the majority and minority spin, have a different lifetime. Also have a slightly different velocity, but an important factor is also that they have a different lifetime. And you can easily show that for a band structure like nickel or cobalt, since the majority density of states near the Fermi level is relatively small, that means that a highly excited majority electron has less time, has less possibilities to decay, and thereby will have a longer lifetime. And thereby, the excited majority electrons will travel further. So actually, it means that if I excite my material, I will have a tendency that, in particular, I will spread around my majority electrons. Of course, that could mean that I see a reduction of the magnetic moment. And he did the calculations, and the blue dots are experiments from Hermann Dürr using XMCD, and the gray zone is what they calculated. So although it's an outdoor, our local model reproduces the curves well, also this seems to reproduce the curves well.
Yeah, but these curves are kind of featureless, right?
Sorry?
I mean, these curves are kind of featureless, you just like have some reduction.
Yeah. But approximately on the proper time scale and...
Then again, you put them by hand in a way in the theory.
Kind of, yeah.
But yes? If this is really the case, couldn't you presumably make some kind of experiment similar to some kind of handling?
Yeah. I don't think this is the case, but it could be the case. What I would say, basically, at the end I will show you some experiments which are targeting this question. But just take if you take an experiment, let's say, of 10 nanometer of nickel on an insulating substrate, the electrons can go nowhere, and you have full sight of the whole film, and you still see the magnetization going down. So from that point of view, I mean, honestly speaking, I think this is this super diffuse spin transport can be very important, but my final answer will be that it's not the main mechanism for demagnetization.
So why is it called super diffuse? It's something like energy resolved diffusion.
No. Yeah. Well, the point is that it's not you have a few generations of highly excited electrons. So basically. The ballistic electrons propagate linear in time. If you have diffusive transport, it goes like the square root. And you find out that if you take one hot electron and it scatters a few times, then you are in between. So you are in between two power laws, and that is what they call super diffusive transport.
But it's really diffusive, right?
Well, not really. So because you really start also the calculations are microscopically with ballistic. It's two or three scattering events, and then you see that
the energy relaxes slower than a diffusive scattering, or faster.
No, each scattering event you lose energy.
Yeah,
but the small fraction of energy or everything.
Well, it's such that you thermalize in four or five.
It sounds like a diffusion to me. Together with some energy relaxation on top of
it. Yeah, well, of course. Yes,
I think it's many.
I don't understand. It's just So it's a diffusion or not, basically.
No, well.
It's different than regular diffusion because you have the velocity essentially changing
it says diffusion is some angularization, slow angularization.
Yeah. But you could say it's immediate case because if you turn knobs, it becomes purely ballistic.
Yeah, I mean, usual diffusion is in space, and this is a bare edge space.
Well, it's combined.
But ballistic, what do you mean ballistic on the time scale of energy relaxation?
Well, ballistic would be if I create a hot electron and it moves somewhere, until there it deposits its energy. But now what it does, it goes there, it excites another electron, two with a reduced energy, and those both move again in a random direction. But if I continue that process, at some point I will find that it's purely diffusive indeed. But as long as there's just a few with one generation it's clear, with one generation it's purely ballistic. So the propagation is linear in time. If it's an infinite number of scattering events, it becomes diffusive and...
It's ballistic before it interacts with other electrons.
But it's almost full. Yeah.
Interacting with other electrons.
I think always if you go to a microscopic length of time scale, diffusion, becomes something like ballistic.
Yeah, right.
Yes, this is the intermediate case which you're treating.
So now, there are two time scales here, crudely speaking. And what am I missing? So one time scale is some kind of interpass.
Yes.
And another time scale is just electron-electron interaction.
Yes.
Right? And you're saying that somehow there's like a crossover, like it could be in one time scale larger than the other, that you call ballistic, and other way around, kind of diffusive, or...
Okay, so elastic mean free path is irrelevant.
Is it true?
Certainly, for the first generation, it is. Because the first generation has a very...
So then it's basically just a Galilean...
Because the highly excited electrons have such a short lifetime due to electron-electron scattering, then there the elastic scattering is... But at some point, of course, it will become relevant. And I must admit that I should check the paper again to find out how they exactly model that.
I mean, if it's relevant, then it could only be diffusion or something.
But superdiffusion is a kind of protected term, basically. That is what you would call indeed superdiffusion. Yeah. Well, that's what they found. That basically. Okay. Yeah.
So it's due to basically electron-electron interactions.
Certainly the start, and whether at the end they also include inlets, I don't know.
So, just the experiment.
Yeah.
So, what's the length scale of this experiment in your
room? They typically do I think it's tens of nanometers. Yes.
So, this is presumably comparable with the. So how is this, in some sense, how is this different than just an accumulation?
At some level, it's not. Right? You're creating hot electrons and they leave the air.
But
they're leaving faster than they otherwise, because they're hot electrons. Yeah. And then they cool down. And then they stop leaving quite as fast, and they become very diffusive.
I think it's some point. The only important is that it is coming on top of the equilibrium dynamics there is. So because this is not in a specific direction. So once these carriers have thermalized, you are just in the equilibrium system, and all the spin currents in an equilibrium system will cancel out. So it's only what is on top of the equilibrium system situation. Which is of relevance here, of course. There's a lot of you could say diffusive transport in any material going on at finite temperatures, but the spin current to all directions is the same. And here the special thing is that since you make locally a in the sense you could say it's a bit like what you have in spin currentronic or a spin dependent Seebeck effect. I mean, if you locally have a different temperature, then you create spin currents. And now this is not by a different temperature, but by individual excited electrons. So I think that is maybe another way of looking at it.
But the quantity that we're interested in is just spin density, right? The way spin density.
Yes.
But why isn't it just like ordinary diffusion in a sense? Because you know electron-electron interactions already introduce it's like impedance for spin current, right?
Of course.
In some complicated energy-dependent fashion. Why isn't it so similar to ordinary diffusion in a sense? Because individual, already a single scattering of two electrons kind of damps out spin current, right?
Yes.
But of course,
Maybe the fact that you talk about super diffusive makes it more complicated because it's already closer to the equilibrium transport. If you think purely about the first generation, the hot electrons, it's clear that it has a different character. So if I create one hot electron here, it moves linearly in time through the material, which is a different property
until it scatters. And the first time it scatters.
Yes, and then you can say, okay, it's there.
But not if it's electron electron scattering, right? Because that doesn't. That doesn't relax momentum.
Yeah, but it relaxes spin current.
Spin current.
That's all you need. Spin current is you know, kills spin current right away.
No. It preserves the amount of spins, of course.
Yeah, but not that much.
So that is an important point.
The way it goes.
Because you have it.
You start with one hot electron. It moves, then you excite another electron. So you get more and more carriers, but the total amount of spin they carry stays one.
But it's a process. So spin propagates diffusively beyond.
So and once it starts to move diffusively, then you cannot discriminate anymore between with the background dynamics there is in transport. So then there is no net spin current anymore. Because, I mean, then this one moves to the left, but the other moves to the right.
You still have a temperature gradient.
Yes, but I will talk about whether that is relevant as well.
That's very problem now.
It certainly is described by a Boltzmann equation.
Okay.
I think.
but
is there anything which is
not a linearized Boltzmann equation?
Yeah, well, that's good enough. Also, my word super diffusive seems fancy for something.
Yes, well, I fully agree. That indeed this super diffuse or at least maybe ballistic, whatever, that the spin transfer plays a role. There are a couple of experiments in literature. One of them we did a couple of years ago, where actually we did a follow experiment. We have two compound PMA materials, platinum cobalt like, separated by a spacer. And we have the possibility to have the two ferromagnets either parallel or anti-parallel. And we're going to heat the system. The total stack is extremely thin, so homogeneously heated. But basically, these hot electrons will move around only if there's a metallic spacer. If there's an oxidic spacer, they cannot. And you could expect then, in this case, that depending on whether a ferromagnetic or anti-ferromagnetic alignment, that the demagnetization proceeds in a different way. And we did experiment. It's a very subtle experiment, but you see that, so basically in red and in black, are the demagnetization traces, which you have seen before, but now for the parallel and the anti-parallel and the parallel alignment in red and in black. And you see for the nickel oxide spacer, they're exactly on top of each other. Whereas for the metallic spacer, you see that for the anti-parallel alignment, the demagnetization proceeds a slight little bit faster, and also during the first hundreds of femtoseconds, there's a bit more demagnetization. And this would indeed be, you could say, assistance of the local process by additional spins which are intermixed between the two layers. Yes? Yeah, the reason why we used it is that you get a very nice, we wanted to a certain the proper coupling between the layers, and that goes very well with nickel oxide, where you have a layer by layer ferromagnetic to antiferromagnetic coupling. But in principle, the antiferromagnetic character should not play a role because the barrier is high enough for electrons that they are not transparent. It might be another subtlety, but I think the fact that the nickel oxide is an antiferromagnet does not play a role.
Isn't there now a paper that just came out that's saying that you can generate spin currents from these
antiferromagnetic
components?
Oh, that's probably a different
thing.
I'm not sure what
powers
they had, but I think it was
around the excitation. I'm not sure whether I know exactly, but have a look at it. Even more exciting, very recently.
Quick question. So in this type of experiment, can you go back? This ruthenium type of experiment,
yeah.
Did you also change thickness?
Yes. And for practical reasons, we are limited to thicknesses where the coupling is antiferromagnetic, but we did it on the first two thicknesses where that is, and you see indeed that the effect decreases if you go from the thinnest to a bit thicker.
What yes. about this cobalt platinum stack?
Oh, the
diffuse across the whole thing.
Yeah, no, interesting question, but we didn't have, Yes. Well, but I will show you that is a more interesting experiment.
Okay.
So this is recently an experiment where now you have nickel and iron on top of each other. And the interesting thing is that iron has a very high Curie temperature. And that means that the decay of the magnetization as a versus temperature around room temperature is very small. That basically means if I heat up iron, there's hardly any demagnetization. If nevertheless I would pump additional spins into the iron of the proper orientation, I could get a super magnetization. And that is what they measured. So you see now, if you have them in the parallel alignment, you heat it up, the nickel just goes down by a local process, but the iron goes up. And it's a very surprising experiment. And also a lot of questions, because you see that the iron magnetic moment, atomic magnetic moment, is almost 20% higher than in equilibrium. So that's a very highly energy state. And nevertheless, you see that if the experiment is correct, it stays there for picoseconds. So that's a very surprising result.
What also, in this type of experiments, people try to measure, so let's say it's a junction, right? Like
yes.
Nickel iron.
Yes.
Also voltage that develops.
Yes. Those are interesting questions. Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Can it matter?
I think this has been. Especially if you take. You better take. I think a tunnel junction.
Yeah.
Where the barrier height is lower than the excitation energy, and I think there are experiments where you then create a voltage.
But then there's metallic systems, especially when you start putting this kind of spin
pressure. But of course, there's a very rapid backflow.
Oh, but it's like some electric effect, right? There's still voltage that's measured, right? It's a balance, right? You have.
But you pump it by a femtosec in 100 femtoseconds, and if the
screening charge is back,
the screening will bring back within a few femtoseconds. I think
there's. No, I'm not talking about screening. I'm talking about the electrochemical potential that develops. Electrochemical potential. Right. Of course, all the screening gets equilibrated very quickly.
Yes.
But then there must be some leftover electrochemical potential, because just like if nothing else, by analogy to thermal electricity, right? If you have a bias that's built into the system, then must.
But bias is built into the system. You mean because it's effect?
Yeah, because of this kind of of this kind, right?
This is something which I would be interested to discuss with you, because I have difficulties understanding it, and I will give you an argument in one or two slides from now.
Okay. A big problem, though, of course, is you can't get your laser through your voltage probe.
Well, why not if it's in an us?
What do you make electrical contact with? If you make it remotely, you're measuring remotely. Right? If you put the electrical contact right on top, how thick a metal do you need?
Well, a couple of nanometers to look through. And of course, you only need the thin film the thin contact at the place where you want to get through, and for the rest you can make a thicker one. So I think that that's not intrinsically a problem in these experiments. Okay, so the actual experiment. What I showed so far, the spin diffusion experiment, super diffuser, spin transport, or ballistic, whatever you want to call it, it was all in collinear systems. And you could say that is fine as long as in the experiments of Malinowski, where you just let your transport assist the convergence to a stable final state. But in the other case, like in the iron experiment, you end up in a very peculiar state, because if, let's say, this is my iron, I pump in additional spins, spin up, so this will be the final state. And then the question is, this is a huge shift of the chemical potential in one of the subbands. So since it is electrically contacted with the environment, you would expect spin currents to screen this effect, apart from the fact that you would also expect that there's local dissipation of angular momentum taking place at hundreds of femtoseconds per second. So this is a kind of strange state. So basically, the experiments look very, very clear. I don't know if there is a pitfall in the experiment, whatever, but this is certainly a very complicated state to end. It would be very exciting to be able to preserve it for a long time, but not the most trivial one. So you can.
I wonder if this is really capacitive effect, kind of important. Yeah. Depending on, you put like a capacitive plate nearby,
yeah,
that will help screening, for example, and behavior will change.
Yeah. Actually, it is much more interesting to go to non-collinear systems, where, let's say, if I have an electrode magnetization up, I now pump spins which are orthogonal, because those are dissipating their angular momentum very efficiently. And then I end up in an equilibrium state, which is just canted a little bit, as picturized here. So this is just an angular momentum transfer. And this is a much more stable state, because the only, it might be slightly off the easy axis, but the dynamics with this cause is very slow. So this is a much better defined state, and may be much more easily be detected. And a much more efficient way, probably, of spin transfer. So, just a couple of reasons why to do the experiment. It thereby may be easier to quantify the amount of spin transport, because basically I just dump it there, and there it is preserved as a canting. It's stored in the system. I might have another handle now to address again this issue of the irrelevance of superdiffuser spin transport in these ultrafast demagnetization experiments. At some point, you might even think maybe there's a possibility to completely switch by a single laser pulse to exploit the effect. And triggered by the talk yesterday, you could even say, well, the nice thing is now I can measure my spin transfer torque without having to go to lithography. But a lot of other complications which you have this way. But okay, so there's a bit of motivation. So this is the experiment now. We have a cobalt-nickel multilayer with a PMA anisotropy, perpendicular magnetic anisotropy, a thicker cobalt in-plane film. We come in with a laser. Then we have super diffusive or ballistic currents going in-plane polarized to the bottom layer, out of plane to the top layer. And thereby, this angular momentum is being deposited locally, and I get a rotation of my magnetization. Now, locally, the two states are no longer along the effective anisotropy field. And that actually means that after this, there is a precession of both layers. Now, this precession I can very easily detect optically. I do a manual optical measurement. I come in with a weaker delayed propulse. I do a polar measurement and thereby detect the Z component of the oscillating magnetization. And thereby I can quantify how much of angular momentum has been transferred during the first initial picoseconds. So this, in a nutshell, is the experiment. Sorry.
You always see precession in this thing?
Well, I tend to say no, but what do you mean with always?
Well,
Because we were doing some experiments at NIST, right?
Yes.
So in this system, if I go back to what we did, we only saw precession for one specific current direction. So and that was electrons flowing from the, and we know why this happens is because of the angular dependence. But this was only for electrons. So you only see precession in the perpendicular isotropy layer if the electrons are flowing from the perpendicular isotropy layer to top.
I do not see why there should be.
Ultrapath dynamics.
We do electrical stuff.
That's a totally different regime, right?
It's a totally different regime, but there's a reason for it. It's because of the spin angular dependence, spin torque angular dependence.
Yeah. I don't know, maybe there is indeed, the good thing here is, this experiment, is that the transfer is so fast and you can very easily work against, and there's no dissipation again, there's no precession going on during the pumping. So you in a flash, you bring it to an other state, and then there is no, if you look at it, there's no reason why this should only go one way.
But it can be, there are a variety of kinetic states in the system.
Yeah.
So there's, depending on whatever external conditions and things, you can have kinetic states.
Yes.
This is your system.
Yes.
You can have kinetic states.
Yes. Yes.
In this plane.
Yes.
Or in this plane.
Yes.
But if you just kinetic and you let it relax, you cannot tell whether this is a precessing state or just a kinetic state.
I'm not sure whether I get your point, but there may be something because there's one artifact you have to take care to eliminate, and I'm not sure whether that is what you're referring to.
The difference between what you do and what we do is that we look at much longer time scales.
Yes.
Okay?
Yeah.
So we can actually, is that in some sense is comparing a DC measurement to a frequency resolved measurement? Okay. If I make a measurement in DC with a and I just use as a probe, I use DMR, right?
Yeah.
So in DC, I cannot tell the difference between, so if I see, let's say I have some magnitude resistance between parallel and antiparallel. If I see a measure resistance which is halfway through, this can be a static state, which is 90 degrees.
Yes.
So it can also be a precessing state where I'm just average on magnetization.
Oh yeah, no, but here we explicitly, but of course, here we explicitly see the precession. We do not see it. We've got DC.
You hit it to
the
pulse.
Yes.
And you kept it off the equilibrium.
Yes.
And then you probe the state.
Yes.
But as you kept it off the axis, the thing is going to precess around the local field and relax.
Yes.
So you would anyway get precession, even if what you are doing is just kenting it, and if you would
change
the state, it would be a static state.
Yes. But you will never. The pitfall is that if the original situation is not along a symmetry axis,
then
I will come to that. By heating the system, you change the anisotropy, and thereby you get an other driving force for precession.
The direction won't be the same. So as long as you can't,
yeah, but apart from this effect, you certainly are not going to count it.
What I'm saying is the state you are driving during your pulse, while your pulse is there, maybe just a static state.
Yes.
If you just probe it afterwards, you cannot tell.
Yeah.
You have different frequencies often.
Yes.
So do you just measure it in real time and decompose? How do you know which one?
The slide after this one, I show the result. Yes. Yeah. So a bit more details about the effect, just the thicknesses, the in-plane film, 3 nanometer, 4 repeats of cobalt nickel. Just checking that indeed we have the proper equilibrium states, applying a field at 45 degrees so that you have an in-plane and out-of-plane component. You do a longitudinal Mohg experiment where you're sensitive to both orientations, and you see that at small fields you switch the bottom out-of-plane layer and here you switch the in-plane layer. So this is exactly what a nice 4 remnant states up left, up down, the 4 combinations you have at zero field available. Then we do experiment. we excited. This is now a time scale of a nanosecond, so this is the slower time scale. Of course, a lot of exciting dynamics taking place in the first picosecond, which I was first addressing. This is slower dynamics. This is the signal. And you can deconvolute it indeed see two components. Yes, two frequencies. That could be the two precessing magnetization vectors. Now, in order to measure the precession, we apply an in-plane field. And we can tune the in-plane field and look at the dispersion of the two modes. And you see that the one, the top layer, behaves like an in-plane, or the highest frequency behaves like an in-plane precession, and the other behaves more or less like a perpendicular precession. So we know exactly that the higher, the highest frequency is the bottom layer, and the lower is the other one.
Yeah. So for this, do you also look at what happens for the first 100 femtoseconds? So then we can, and can you distinguish, you know, the amount of angular momentum that's been relaxed?
You can quantify the. Yes.
You said that there's this kind of very fast electron phonon relaxation channel for spin.
Yes.
And there's also Can you somehow try to quantify how much has been relaxed and how much has been actually transformed?
Yeah, I have a number which I quote in two or three slides. Well, at least a partial answer to your question.
Okay, but basically here you're thinking that mostly it's transfer.
Well, no, I don't give any answer. I only see that they end up in two precessing layers. That's the. I give it a kick and I see this. And how much canting there is, etc. I mean,
I will
come later. So first, let's try to see whether this is what we expect. Of course, we now can go through the four different states and see that. I will not go through detail, but you can imagine that you can now see whether some of the oscillations reverse sign if I change the orientation of one of the layers. For instance, if I remove, if I change the bottom one, I will pump the other spins, etc. And if you take your time, you find that this is consistent. So, in principle, this could be spin transfer torque. One experiment to do, we did it with copper so far, and we see this. You can also put a heavy spin scatter in between, and then you see that you quench one of the two precessions, one of the layers. And actually, it turns out that what you quench is the top one. And so actually, it seems that if there is a spin transfer torque, it does not arrive anymore in the top film, whereas in the bottom one, I still see precessions. And that's something which needs to be explained, but it could be that there is an other effect which also introduces precession.
What happens when you heat up the other side of the sample?
Nothing, because there is a 1 millimeter of or half a millimeter of silicon. In principle, you can. Yes. All things. I mean, we also do experiments on transparent substrates. So basically, in principle, that could also be done. So, but.
But they are on the top layers.
He is
only top layer.
But again, the thickness are such that you excite both layers. You're a bit more sensitive to the top one for different reasons. But
the laser goes through pretty much.
Pretty much, yes. Yeah. Otherwise, I wouldn't get. Otherwise, I wouldn't create a spin current upwards. So this is looks all makes sense. Yes.
You have a certain attenuation terms in the
yes.
Laser.
Yes. Yes.
Then you're probably exciting the top layer more
yes.
than you're
yes.
exciting
yes.
the bottom.
Yes.
So
yes.
That means that you're always putting more spin current from top
yes.
to bottom than from bottom
yes.
to top.
Yeah.
Which is what your experiment is doing.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, it makes sense that there's more spin current downwards than upwards.
Which is a little bit
but, more. A factor of two or so. At the end, we mapped that all because there's also the efficiency of measuring. Of course, it's also more sensitive to the top one. I mean, that is something we all quantified. Some of the numbers will appear, some not. But basically, that is something you can work out. So you can do it in more detail. You see that indeed for the platinum it goes down very rapidly. The oscillation. This is the oscillation period as a function of thickness, And for the copper, it goes down much more gently. That would be consistent with spin transfer torque. And now coming to the quantification, here is now an absolute scale, and that is the effect is at maximum 2%. And this is now calibrated according to the amount of demagnetization of the bottom film. So I see how many, 1/50th of the spins which are flipped in the bottom film to get the magnetization of the cobalt nickel down are transferred to the top one. So it's a small, it's not that you need 100% or so to get these effects, just a small margin of them is deposited in the other.
Right, but at the same time, a bunch of spins at the bottom have actually relaxed due to electron hole interaction. How much magnetization do you see coming from the bottom layer?
Also
just 2%?
No.
So you can measure torque on one side, on the other, do this spin. How to distinguish between transfer
angle
and local demagnetization?
Yes. Well, the interesting thing is that the top layer is cobalt with a high Curie temperature, so the top layer actually hardly demagnetizes. The bottom one is mostly nickel, and there's a strong demagnetization. So therefore, we now calibrate it to the nickel. So what you see, the bottom layer, if it decreases its magnetization by a certain amount, 2% is used for canting the top layer.
2% of the demagnetization?
Yes. That's what the number says here. Yes. There's an other number which you might be interested in. You can also say basically now this precession. What is the precession cone? Well, this original 2% corresponds to a precession, an out-of-plane tilt by 0.06 degrees. So if it now starts to precess in an elliptical way, it is typically 0.1 times 0.6 degrees. So a small angle precession.
So you can do that local polarization processes dominate, and you have on top of it a little bit of spin transfer.
That could be the conclusion, yes.
Excuse me.
Yes.
Do you have any effects of spin pumping? You're talking about spin transfer torque, but...
Yeah, but spin pumping will add to the damping of this, and we're only interested in the frequency. So it could indeed, yeah, of course you will have, if you probe, these modes are damped out. And of course, part of that could be due to spin pumping. But I mean, that's something we did not, if you're interested in spin pumping, you do a different experiment.
But it would still be nice to see how that happens across platinum versus copper, just for context.
No, I mean, there's a lot.
It's not just damping, this type of bilayer, the spin pumping couples with the modes. Yes, so especially the frequencies start crossing as synchronization attacks. Something complementary.
No, and a lot, I fully agree with many questions. I mean, all of things have to be done, but basically this is just the first coherent set of measurements which show that the effect works and that we can get quantitative numbers. And then for the rest, I advise all of you to contribute in the working problems. I think I should... maybe this is interesting to tell because there is
you already
got a flavor that there is maybe some spin transfer, but maybe there's also another contribution. And there is, so far I spoke about the amplitude and about the frequency, but also the phase is extremely important. And that's indicated here for the case of the precession of the in-plane layer. And let's assume I pump spin-up spins into it. If this would be an ultra-short spin transfer torque pulse, I can write this in relative yield, but I also can say basically this is direct transfer of angular momentum. So this one is canted upwards. And I would get a kind of cosine-like precession. And if I fit it with a sine, that means a phase of plus pi over 2. If it would be, in this case, it would be minority spins. If it would be majority spins, I would observe the opposite phase. Whereas if rather than having an ultra-short pulse, I have a spin transfer torque pulse, which would preserve for a time much longer than the precessional period, you can derive, and let's skip that, but you can easily see that you're getting 90 degrees out of phase. So a short impulse or a step-like thing also gives 90 degrees out of phase. So basically, looking at the phase, you get a lot of information.
But the step like has to be on the scale of
The step has to be on the scale of, let's say, the precessional time.
Which is some sub-nanoseconds.
Yeah.
But do you have anything happening on that?
Well, it could be a temperature gradient, which is preserved for a longer time, for instance. You hear that would be an option.
So temperature is preserved on the scale of nanoseconds.
Well, the decay there is typically tens to hundreds of picoseconds. So that could if you would have a temperature pulse, that would probably have a different phase. Yes. Yes. You can simulate that, but I also have a slide on that.
So, just to understand this slide, so now you're just considering what, all these plots with the bottom one.
Yeah?
The MZ of the top
layer. Yeah. So, basically, what is here, the blue line is the case that I have a very short spin momentum pulse, and the pulse is over, but I have displaced my magnetization vector out of the plane, and from that moment it starts to precess. And you see it precesses like a cosine wave. And here the phase is pi over 2 in terms of the sine function. If I would keep on my spin transfer pulse continuously like this, then I will see I will keep on going, and I will have a sine-like behavior with a phi of 0. And you can easily derive that there is exactly a 90 degrees phase difference between this perturbation and a step-like perturbation. That's one thing. The other thing is that there is, I already mentioned, yes?
What's the result of measurement for the phase?
Be patient.
It's minus pi over 2. The artifact, and that's most dominantly present for the out-of-plane bottom layer, because I said for experimental reasons we have to apply an in-plane field. So we have the anisotropy field perpendicular, but we apply in-plane field, so now we have a cantered state of the bottom one. Now if we now heat up the system by temperature, we will just change the anisotropy field. And the anisotropy field, either it increases or decreases, but it means that the effective field starts to cant and is no longer along the magnetization direction, and also then I get a precession, even without any spin transfer torque, just because a local rise of the temperature. You can do the same analysis and also find there that you can discriminate again between the long anisotropy pulse and a short anisotropy pulse.
What kind of anisotropy? So this is on crystalline.
In this case, it's the PMA anisotropy, but with also the shape anisotropy works. So basically, I would say always, I mean, in a magnetic system, you always have an anisotropy.
The shape anisotropy would require the non-perception.
Yes.
So here, this is anisotropy, but even though magnetization didn't change, let's say, right?
Of course, this is the nickel cobalt layer, so there will also be a change in the saturation magnetization. So also, the in-plane component of the anisotropy field. So it's a combination.
Okay, the long time, after the magnetization happens.
But have you actually tried to measure this? Because for the perpendicular anisotropy, you want to measure the effective perpendicular anisotropy.
Yes, yeah.
You
will
reduce the perpendicular
anisotropy,
but you also decrease MS.
Yes. I agree. So we did not explicitly measure this time dependent, but in principle we could derive it from the phase of the experiment, which of the two is dominating. I agree that the two components.
All right, so what's the bottom line?
Excuse me.
Yes?
Is the heating of the electrons doing something? I mean, if you have a long pulse, right, yes. I would expect the electrons to be pretty heated up too. Is that playing a role at all, or it's not? Considering sort of heating effects on the magnetism aspect, but
yes.
I would expect that if you have such a long pulse, the electrons also heat up.
But it's not that the system is heated up. So basically, at time equals zero, you rise the temperature, and then it takes time for the energy to diffuse out of the film.
So that, on this time scale, this is not common temperature. Right?
Yes, the complicated
thing is that it has a very fast initial drop and a slower tail, so there are you could expect that both components play somehow a role.
But electron and magnetron temperature is probably the same thing.
Yeah, but at these time scales, all temperatures have conservation.
It's a little bit different on the picosecond
temperature. No. Well, but here you're talking about longer. You're talking about the precessional time scale. So, I mean, all the non-equilibrium stuff I talked in the beginning about is not of relevance. Yeah. All the subsystems have well equilibrated. Now, okay, this is now you can do analysis for the top layer, the bottom layer, the short spin transfer torque, long pulse, the delta K, short and long. We measure actually both for the top and the bottom one. You see a minus cosine-like behavior, so minus pi over 2, which actually means that only two options left for the in-plane layer, either a majority pulse, which is very short, or a long delta K pulse. And for the out-of-plane layer, it must be a minority current pulse or also a long delta K. So you have already excluded a lot. I think I will. You'll get the idea that basically by looking at the frequency, the amplitude, and the phase, you can discriminate. And we find that for the top layer, the only thing which is possible is the spin transfer torque pulse from the bottom one. And for the bottom one, it is only the delta K. Now, you can also change the angle of the applied field slightly, do the same analysis, and then find the same result. So we're very sure that the top layer, the effects, the precession top layer, must be due to spin transfer torque, because we excluded all other things. So that is then the final line. Precession of the top layer is consistent with ultra-fast spin transfer torque. You can also argue why there is no additional effect due to the delta K, because this is the film which has the cobalt film with a very large Curie temperature, so there's hardly any demagnetization, and the top layer only has a shape anisotropy, so that is not changing if you just heat up the system marginally.
For the
bottom one, it's reversed. So basically, there we know that. There are two reasons for that. First of all, because of the lower Curie temperature, the delta K mechanism is much more efficient, and thereby it can overwhelm the other effects. But moreover, if you now look to the details of the experiment, you find that we are 7 times as efficient to the top layer than the bottom one, due to a combination of effects.
Materials
parameters, yes. Yeah.
But it could be partially used by spin transfer.
I'm sure there is that there will be also spin transfer torque in the bottom one. But it's too small for us to measure.
No, I'm just saying that for this particular flow of electrons, the only thing spin transfer torque gives you is the camping in the direction of the magnetization.
Yes.
And this is what you assume when you say, okay, I'm changing temperature or whatever, so I'm changing the anisotropy.
Yeah.
And because I have an in-plane field, I'm going to change the angle of the magnetization.
Yeah.
But you cannot separate the change that comes from the torque that you get from the electrons coming from top to bottom and the change in the angle
no, from temperature. No, but wait a minute. We can separate by all these additional measurements. The point is that
this is not. This is so in this configuration. Yeah. You only get static states. You don't get dynamic states.
No. But wait a minute. During the first 100 femtosecond, it is impossible to change the magnetic orientation by a change in anisotropy. You only can change the effective field, and the magnetization responds to that in a very slow way. So the only possible mechanism which really changes the orientation is either a thermal demagnetization or a spin transfer from orthogonal spins from another region. It is impossible in 1 picosecond to change the orientation by the very small anisotropy fields because the time scales are different. So it is not, you can discriminate between the two. Let's discuss that.
I think I'm almost
done, and I should. Okay, then because then I'm finding
what is the reason?
And I already referred to that a bit, because we know when this delta K mechanism is there, the torque due to delta K. But then actually there can still be two solutions. One is the thermal gradients,
and the other is the ballistic
or super diffusive transport. For the thermal gradients with an explicit calculation, based on the optical parameters, we can calculate an optical absorption profile. You say a lot of absorption in platinum cobalt, little in the copper, more in cobalt, nickel, platinum, and no in the silicon oxide substrate that you have on these. Then, by doing simple thermal calculations, we can calculate the transient temperature profiles. We see basically, this is negative time delay, 0.1, 0.5, 500. So you see that the top is heated by about 200 kelvins, and especially in the cobalt nickel, we have a large temperature gradient recently of 7 kelvin per nanometer, but decays very rapidly. And that's indicated here, the red line. You see, initially you have strong temperature gradients.
Now, but the question is, the laser size important now?
No, it's one-dimensional.
Yes. But on this time scale, maybe the lateral.
No, not yet.
It's still unimportant.
Yes, yes.
So
yeah. Yes, 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 yes.
But it goes into substrate eventually?
Eventually, yes.
And you still can neglect the outflow?
Yes. Yes, during the first 100 or one, even not 1 nanosecond. I mean, we have a laser spot of typically 10 microseconds. So basically, the depth scale is 10 nanometer, and the lateral scale is 10 micrometer. So that's.
Yeah, but now you're waiting for like a picosecond.
Yeah, but that's
still okay.
Yes, yeah. No, that's a very solid approximation. So you know the temperature gradients, you know how much, thereby, how much spin Seebeck currents there is, how much spin-dependent Seebeck currents. We calculated that. You calculate now the chemical potentials, etc., in the material based on the thermal gradients. And you can, based on that, you can find the spin the spin currents. And you can see how much spin is transported from one layer to the other. Those of you who are interested, I mean, it's interesting maybe to go to, but I will do that later. The final outcome is that thereby you have about 3 millidegrees of canting, whereas we measure almost 2 orders of magnitude larger. So this does not seem to be...
This is spin-dependent Seebeck.
Yes, spin-dependent Seebeck, yes. Okay, yeah.
You could actually have this kind of spin Seebeck.
Yes.
Okay,
well, that's what I just throw in. I mean, basically,
A refined spin
Maybe, yes. Would be very interesting.
Okay.
And the other, sorry?
Because, I mean, this was all now, all of a sudden, purely diffusive calculations.
Yes.
So why?
Because that's the only thing where you have a theoretical framework. I mean, this is more.
It's not obvious. Okay, if I would believe this one paper about super diffusive.
There's no reason why the temperature diffusive equation
should still.
No, I agree. So, but let me put it differently. I mean, of course, the two are somehow related to each other, but you try now which theoretical framework could match this experiment.
But here, this is longer
time scale,
right?
Yeah. So, that is the difficulty is, you see that you have this red line is the thermal gradient. And you see that it is during the first, you have a huge thermal gradient during the first picosecond, but then it decays, so the temperature does not go down very rapidly, but you can imagine initially, so basically you very rapidly on a nanometer length scale, you get a very flat profile. So the temperature is still in the film. The temperature is in the film, you see, for hundreds of picoseconds. But the gradients are damped out very rapidly.
So the gradient happens only initially?
The gradient
only initially. And then basically, and the blue line, the blue line is the integrated, the time integrated gradient. So you see,
you get the effect, right?
You see that there is a short pulse first, but then on the longer time scale, it's still, this is on hundreds, there is this tiny effect here on a long time scale, integrates out to also given
it. 3 millidegrees, that's really this kind of initial kick?
Yes.
Okay.
No, it's the sum of everything. Yes.
But didn't you say you want to kind of explain this minus pi over 2?
Yes.
Then shouldn't it be initial kick only?
This is just an order of magnitude.
I mean, it just to get the feeling
of how large effect it is.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, and this is actually what I mentioned before, that for super diffusion, in principle, you have enough spins in the system moving around. Only 2% of demagnetization has to be transferred, and thereby we believe that if you will do a good superdiffusive transport calculation, it might well give you the proper answer. But we did not do the proper calculation yet. The only thing which I do want to mention is that we are sure that we measure a majority spin current, and that is consistent with the superdiffusive spin current model. And the final thing is that you should own something which is mostly neglected in the superdiffusive calculations, but of course you do not, I mean, you cannot have charge being pumped away. This is immediately screened. And also the screening charge will be spin polarized. So you have to add more to the calculations, which is what you, and I invite you to do. So forget this. Then two final slides. Sorry that it took so long, but I think the discussion is already integrated in the talk. Is it now also that we do measure these super diffusive spin currents? Are they a strong contributor to demagnetization? And for that, we indeed did the experiment with front and back pumping. And you could imagine that if I pump and probe from the front, independent of whether it's local heating or transport, in all cases I should see the magnetization going down. But if I pump from the back and probe from the front, if it's local dissipation of angular momentum, I should see the magneto-optical signal going down. If it's transport, it should go up, because if I pump my spin density from the back side, it must be appear at the front side. So now we do two experiments.
Always probing. So that's a thick nickel film?
It's about 10, 20 nanometers. We did it over a whole wedge. But I think we went up to 30 nanometers. And 30 nanometers, then you only have a few percent of transmission left. 10% of transmission left. But I mean, the symmetry is clear. So basically, if it's all about transport, it cannot be that whatever you measure, it's going down. Then if it goes down to the one side, it must appear at the other side. And this is now the experiments done for thicknesses up to 30 nanometers here, probing from the front, pumping from the front and pumping from the back. And in all cases, you see, independent of thickness, you see the signal going down. So you now have a film which is isolated because you have a transparent substrate, a freestanding film of a film between 5 and 30 nanometer of nickel. You heat it up, and you see from which side I look, everywhere I see the magnetization going down. So it does not mean that there are no super diffusive spin currents, but it does seem to indicate that those are not dominating the loss of magnetic moment.
If you're on an insulating substrate.
Yes, yes. But the features you see on an insulating substrate are extremely similar to what you see in a metallic substrate. So if you apply the same parameters for a film on the insulating substrate, you can exactly reproduce what you see in a metallic substrate. So certainly there will be some effect, but it seems to be certainly not dominant.
Which is consistent with the other solid.
Yes. So, since Yaroslav said it should end with more questions than conclusions, I only pop up a lot of questions. Maybe just acknowledging them again for all the contributions, group members, and therewith I can leave you with a lot of questions, but I won't go through them. But I thank you for your attention.
Can I do an experiment? Maybe I've done it. Where you have a single magnetic layer on top of either a good or bad spin sync, so copper versus platinum, and then see how.
No, we didn't do that. We did work with the last experiment. We also did with a nickel on a metallic. So basically, I showed the experiment. Here, nickel on sapphire, we also inserted a heat sink, a metallic heat sink underneath of aluminum. And then the effect should be larger, of course, because then the spins can disappear at the backside.
Okay.
So, and that is an experiment we did. And then also probe from the backside, and still we saw that independent of how we pump and probe, there's no effect. And we also see that the way the magnetization goes down is not affected. But that is actually, in that case, if you have too much aluminum at the bottom side, you cannot measure from the, you cannot penetrate anymore. But then you can see whether the way the magnetization goes down is affected by having the aluminum at the bottom side. And within the measurement accuracy, that was not possible to distinguish.
Yeah, but so I expect you have a metal, a magnet, yes. Either a good or bad spacing,
yes.
Backflow would be completely different than that also.
Yeah. Of course, it is always the complications start by having a metallic substrate. Also, the heat goes more efficiently away. So that basically means that the profiles will somehow change, because the peak temperatures are preserved for a shorter time. So it is not that nothing is happening, but everything we saw, we could just ascribe to ordinary heat diffusion and not that spins leak out or so. But it's not always as easy as you might think.
There is one thing which I don't understand. I mean, you pump it locally,
yeah,
which actually means you create the profile of magnetization.
Yes.
And so it processes fast in the middle, and it doesn't process at all.
Yes.
The back, so you have some range of precession frequencies, and you don't see any of that.
No, but not precision frequent. I mean, because you're still, you have a small angular precession, so there's no linearity. So the frequency will not depend on the amplitude.
But it doesn't depend on the direction.
No, because the direction is everywhere the same. But I do. If you want to make the point that in principle you will emit spin waves.
Either because you are also measured
locally. So it will also add to the effective damping.
Yeah. So your probe is also microns.
But I think you don't want to average.
Your probe is actually, microns, right?
By electrical perturbation, you see that you can indeed nicely have these spin waves being launched. Picking them up in this configuration is very difficult because you irradiate in different directions, so they will dilute decay very rapidly. I know years ago we thought about also trying to measure them, and we never pushed it really, but it's a very hard experiment. And again, it will not, the frequency you get already from the first hundreds of picoseconds, and there certainly the spin waves didn't have time to move out. I was still, maximum is 10 to the 4 meter, typically 10 to 4 meter per second, isn't it? 10 minus 5 meters is 10 minus nanoseconds you get, I think, in that case. So it's not completely negligible, but it's a minor effect, and certainly not affecting the frequency significantly. Maybe a tiny bit of more damping that you get.
It doesn't prevent you from seeing this coherent precession.
No. But you saw that most of the precession decayed already after a couple of hundreds of picoseconds. So that's.
Other questions? Well, let's thank the speaker. Don't forget about the soccer practice session, and I already announced to Lars that we're scheduling a rematch sometime next week.